Good afternoon, everyone. I am Dean Reuter, the General Counsel and a Senior Vice President of the Federalist Society. It's my pleasure to welcome you here this afternoon. Thank you for attending this conference today. I think things are going well. I want to begin by thanking Bob Eitel and everyone at DFI. We have co-sponsored, we the Federalist Society, have co-sponsored events before with other organizations, and it's never gone quite as well or seamlessly as it has with DFI. So they have my great affection. So thank you. Again, thank you for being here, and thanks for everybody watching remotely. We certainly appreciate you being here. It is now my pleasure and honor to introduce our luncheon speaker. Bill Barr is very well known to everyone in the room, I am guessing, but just in case, I'll give you some background. He is the twice former Attorney General of the United States, also former General Counsel of GTE and then Verizon, a veteran of several DOJ offices and positions, and the CIA. And he's served on big company corporate boards of directors. Now, the Wikipedia page for Attorney General Barr, which is, of course, always a good source of information, breathlessly reports that Barr, I'm quoting here, Barr is a longtime proponent of the unitary executive theory of nearly unfettered presidential authority over the executive branch of the U.S. government. So I tell you that by way of background. Now, he's also, of course, the author of the best-selling book with what I think is the best title of the year, One Damn Thing After Another. That's going to be available for purchase at the back table, and he'll be signing the book as well after his remarks. And, of course, the fact that he's written a book in retirement reminds me of a very brief story about a man, let's call him Bob. So Bob is announcing his retirement to his colleagues at his longtime employer. And his colleagues ask Bob what he's going to do next in his retirement years. And Bob responds, well, I think I'll finish my book. And his colleague says, Bob, I didn't even know you were writing a book. He says, I'm not writing a book. I'm trying to read a book. So it's a great accomplishment at any point in your life, I think, to actually write a book. Now, Attorney General Barr is going to speak with us today on religion and education. And time permitting, he's going to take some questions. We've got a couple floor mics. His book, which I have read, is much more than a catalog of his time at the Trump administration. It is, although it is that, it's much more than that. He also covers his own early life, his life story, his stints at GTI and Verizon, the CIA, the Department of Justice, his first tenure as Attorney General. It's all fascinating stuff, actually. And he goes into deep discussions of many, many issues of the day, disclosing and I think usefully defending his thinking on a lot of the day's controversies, addressing everything from big tech to crime and policing to protests to the country's various levels of COVID response, race relations, education, and much, much more. I think the broad sweep of the book is very impressive, but it's presented, I would say, briskly and thoroughly, always cogently, often, I think, with wry humor. And I want to give you one quote to highlight that. This concerns Little Sisters of the Poor, a group probably known to this organization. And I'm quoting Bill Barr. If aliens were to arrive from outer space, they would have to think that the Little Sisters of the Poor are one of the most dangerous groups on the planet. I chuckled out loud when I read that. So today we're going to hear from him not just about religious liberty, but about religious liberty and education. So please join me in welcoming Bill Barr.
Thank you, Dean. That was a great introduction. Could you write a review on the book, and at least on Amazon, okay? I'm getting a lot of zeros from the... I never thought I'd write a book. I never kept notes. I always look down on writing a book after you leave government. But a lot of people were calling me after I resigned and saying, you know, you've worked for Reagan, Bush, Trump. You've seen a lot. You really should share that perspective. So I broke down and decided to write the book. And I can only plead post-traumatic stress disorder for that decision. I'd like to thank Dean and my friends at the Federalist Society and Bob Eitel and my friends at DFI for hosting this conference. And above all, I want to thank my friend Secretary Betsy DeVos for her indefatigable leadership on all educational issues, but particularly being a champion for school choice. I think it's a foundational issue and one whose time has come. When I worked at the Reagan administration, one of my issues that was given to me as part of my portfolio was the president's tuition tax credit initiative. And since then, I've been an ardent advocate and really an activist for school choice. And by the time I left at the end of the Bush administration in 1992, I remember saying to my friends that until we fundamentally reform education in this country by achieving school choice, there's really no hope of stopping the steady decomposition of our society, our culture, and our institutions. And I still believe that. School choice is not a panacea. It's not going to solve everything. But there can be no solution unless and until we accomplish it. And that's what I mean by saying that I view it as a foundational issue. It's the sine qua non of restoring some measure of sanity to our society. Let me go back to the original sin, I think, of American public education. Starting in the mid-19th century, the United States, along with most of the Western world, made a noble decision that primary and later secondary education should be universal and therefore should be publicly funded. However, the United States made a wrong turn when it decided that the only way to structure public support for that education was to provide it exclusively inside government-operated schools staffed by public employees. Now, this approach is actually something of an outlier. Generally, the rest of the industrial world has evolved educational systems that allow parents to choose private or religiously affiliated options for their children and provide public funding for that education as long as the schools are academically qualified. I have long thought that it's ironic that our ancestors of those who founded America fled Europe for greater religious liberty. And yet in Britain and in France, probably the most secular country in the world, and elsewhere in Europe, parents can send their children at public expense to religious schools, Catholic, Protestant, Islamic, Sikh, and so forth. The fact that those schools are providing education within a religious context is irrelevant, as long as the secular coursework meets academic standards. It's been clear for decades that the American experiment with a state-run public school monopoly is failing spectacularly. During the COVID pandemic, parents were better able to see the reality of that failure. And today there's more support than ever for fundamental reform of our educational system. Reform does not mean more money. Money has not been the problem. Non-public schools have long been able to accomplish much better results at much lower cost. The problem is the inherent incapacity of a non-accountable state bureaucracy, protected as a monopoly and controlled by teachers' unions, to provide an education of superior quality and rigor, to instill discipline, and to address questions of values and morality and character without undermining the traditional religious beliefs of families. Look around. For most students, the public schools are not even close to doing the job they were set up to do. As originally conceived, public schools were supposed to do three things. First, convey basic technical skills and knowledge, teaching reading, writing, arithmetic, science. Are they doing this? No. The achievement levels of our students in reading, writing, and arithmetic and science are dismal. Public school students are falling far behind other countries in the industrial world, especially China. The gap between American students and students in the large Chinese cities for which we have comparable data is stunning. And we all know that private schools, parochial schools, non-sectarian schools, charter schools are all generally doing a much better job than the average public school in this regard. The United States has been the unrivaled technological leader in the world for more than 150 years. None of us have known a time where the United States was not the technological leader by far. And yet the American people may be taking this for granted. It has been this prowess that has given us our security. It's given us our prosperity, the ability of generation after generation to have it better than the generation before. And it has given us the ability to project a benign influence of liberal democratic ideals around the world. Unless we radically improve our educational system so we can compete, we are going to lose all of this. Second, from their inception, public schools were supposed to promote the melting pot, forging the unum out of the pluribus by fostering a sense of solidarity in our common identity as Americans. Is that happening today? No. Indeed, it's just the opposite. Public schools are teaching kids that they have unbridgeable differences with each other, and that based on their race and ethnicity, they are fated to be either oppressors or victims. And they are also being taught to deprecate the founders and our founding principles as a nation. The ignorance of American students about American history, about American founding, and all the glories of our history is a scandal. In contrast, contrary to the nativist notion that religiously affiliated schools are divisive, those schools, and here the Catholic parochial school system is the most notable example, have been the most successful engines of the melting pot in our country's history, producing from wave upon wave of immigrants patriotic, community-minded, and proud Americans. Third, the paramount mission of education in the West has always been the moral formation of children, the framing of character. I want to discuss how recent developments are shattering the illusion that a government agency can carry out the mission of moral instruction, at least not today. In the classical world before Christ, before the separation of the power of the church and state, it was the state that held all the cards. They had plenary power over all aspects of life. There was no separation of church and state. Religion was subsumed within the state, and moral education was controlled wholly by the state. The state was viewed as the moral agency, whose mission was to instruct people as to what is the good life and then train them how to lead that life. And one attained their highest moral value or end through their participation in the political life of the city-state. Sparta, of course, is the consummate example where boys of 7 years old were taken from the home, committed to government dormitories where they were subject to strict accordance with a state-dictated educational regime. The coming of Christianity destroyed the idea that the state should have the ultimate control over education, especially moral education. Under the concept of separation of church and state, we recognize two autonomous spheres of competence and authority. And because of its inherently moral dimension, education was considered integrally bound up with religion. Education was recognized as a religious function, and it was conducted by the church and the family, not the state. When the state originally stepped forward in the 19th century to assume the educational functions, it did not deny that moral education and religion were inseparable. On the contrary, it explicitly embraced the need for religion in education. Horace Mann, the leader of the Common School movement, frankly acknowledged, quote, "The purpose of education is the moral formation of children, and religion is indispensable to that." In other words, education could not just be about means, it also had to be about ends. And at the end of the day, education necessarily had to bump into the big questions. Who am I, and what am I, and how do I fit into this world around me, and why am I here? Does life have a purpose? What is it to live a good life? What duties do I have to others, and where do those duties come from? The fundamental problem in education has never been that religion presumes to invade the space of education. It is that the educational enterprise, if it has any ambition beyond merely conveying technical skills, inherently intrudes into the realm of religion. The conundrum, of course, in the United States was that under our Constitution, government entities have to be religiously neutral. But how could you get a school into the business of moral instruction, as Horace Mann said, you know, to which religion is indispensable, while at the same time, that institution is bound to be religiously neutral? This has been the conundrum. Now, in the first phase of the public school education, in the first phase of its existence, which lasted more than 100 years, from the mid-19th century to roughly the early 1960s, there was no effort to be neutral. They were able to finesse the problem of religious neutrality by ignoring it. Public schools didn't even pretend to be neutral. They unabashedly incorporated religion as the basis of the moral education they were providing. Religion was incorporated in the form of a general American Protestantism with moral teachings based on the tenets and precepts that the main Protestant denominations shared in common. The Bible was read, prayers were said, general Christian morality was taught. Public schools could get away with this because it was compatible. What they were teaching in the classroom was compatible with the Judeo-Christian beliefs of the overwhelming majority of Americans. Even as late as 1960, 95% of Americans identified as believing Christians. However, the ability to finesse the requirement of religious neutrality evaporated in 1960 or thereabouts. This was the result of two related and parallel phenomena. First, the Supreme Court started enunciating and enforcing a strict neutrality test in the public schools. And second, the American people had become more diverse in their religious views. There was less consensus over the content of morals, values, and social norms. This led to the second phase of public education, which lasted from the mid to late 60s to the middle of the Obama administration. And this was a relentless campaign and a benighted effort to achieve secularization of education, to make it completely neutral religiously. This was done by trying to strip away every vestige of traditional religion from the schools. So this was secularization, as I've said, by subtraction, stripping away all vestiges of traditional religion. But expunging religion does not result in religious neutrality. Instead, the net effect was to elevate the most aggressively secular viewpoints while suppressing any religious viewpoints. The problem is that public morality in the United States is still predicated on the Judeo-Christian worldview. If you take away the Judeo-Christian foundations of morality, you are left with a void. There is no belief system which explains to people why they have to behave or should behave in the way you are telling them they should behave. So around the middle of the Obama administration, the campaign to secularize public schools entered the next phase. The objective was no longer secularization by subtraction, but by addition. Having created a vacuum by removing religious foundations upon which the traditional values were based, they've been busy injecting into the schools alternative belief systems that will support their new secular creed. So what we're seeing today is the affirmative indoctrination of children into ideologies and isms that are substitutes for religion. It includes things like the critical race theory, which is simply a form of Marxist historical materialism that substitutes race antagonism for class antagonism as the determinant of social relationships and of the meta-historical force that controls the trajectory of events. Students are made, for example, to participate in public mea culpa sessions in which they are forced to confess that all that they are is the result of privilege and oppression. Children are also indoctrinated into ideologies like transgenderism that holds that the objective reality of nature is trumped by subjective feelings. Preschoolers are taught, and this is from a coloring book distributed in an Iowa school district, quote, "You can be a boy, a girl, or neither, or anything you want to be, and no one can tell you any different." These are just two examples of what some commentators have called the successor ideology, a pastiche of oppositional ideologies that have in common the tearing down of conventions and values and institutions of today so that they can inevitably be replaced by some perfectly equitable society in the future. But like all such movements, they're very good at tearing down and have never built anything beyond that. These are the ideologies that are now it being injected into the school. But where does the state get off compelling its citizens to submit to this kind of ideological indoctrination? There is no doubt that the state is using compulsion here. Students are a captive audience. The state mandates a certain level of education and then restricts public funding for that education only to government-run schools, so that when the government starts using the classroom for ideological indoctrination, the only way parents can avoid it is to pay through the nose to escape to a private school. That's compulsion. Putting aside for a moment the question whether teaching of these ideologies trenches on the fundamental rights of parents to direct the upbringing of their children or violate the free exercise of religion, there's a threshold question. Where does the state get the authority for this? It's certainly not based on science. It's patently, much of it, such as transgenderism, is patently contrary to objective reality. It's an ideological dogma. Now, the government may have a legitimate interest, even a compelling interest at times, in having its citizens learn to read the same language, write the same language, add and subtract so they can conduct commerce, and other kinds of technical knowledge, maybe even civics and health hygiene and topics like that. But it has no right to tell people what to think. What is the state's compelling interest in promoting purely secular belief systems over, say, traditional systems that are predicated on religious belief? What is the state's compelling interest? The fact that the state is precluded from affirmatively promoting religion does not mean that the state is free to privilege secular belief systems over religious ones. Unfortunately, parents have gotten so used to sending their kids off to government-run schools that some seem to be under the impression that the government and school boards have untrammeled authority over the content of what is presented to students inside those buildings. Oh, it's the school building. It's the school board that decides what goes in there. And that's perfectly fine. It's the government's power and prerogative. It seems to me that this is a regression to the ancient idea that the state is all-powerful and has plenary authority to define for its citizens what a good life is and compel them to adhere to it. This obviously runs contrary to the whole trajectory of Western history and certainly the American proposition that the reach of government over our thoughts and beliefs is limited. Under our system, it is not the role of the government to define what the good life is or to lead men to it or to shape man in its own image. Beyond this, it seems to me that the use of public schools to teach secular ideologies impermissibly encroaches on the fundamental rights of parents to direct the upbringing of their children and on the exercise of their religious liberty. Now, we know the Supreme Court has recognized in a number of cases that parents have a fundamental right to guide the education of their children. And when it comes to the religious dimensions of education, we are really dealing with a compound right that Scalia referred to in his Smith decision. Whether that decision was right or wrong, the point is, he said, when you have the parental rights coupled with another right, as here, education and moral education and its impact on the exercise of religion, you're obviously dealing with a fundamental right. At the core of religious liberty for anyone of faith is the right to raise their children in that faith. And forcing students to submit to indoctrination into ways of thinking that are hostile to it is monstrous and clearly infringes on religious liberty. While I think the violation of the free exercise clause is clear enough, I also think we've reached the point that where some school systems are running afoul of the Establishment Clause. Because we're no longer talking about simply stripping religion out of the school curriculum. We're now talking about indoctrination into affirmative value systems, sort of a new credo resting on materialist metaphysics and taking the place of religion. And this then raises the question whether this involves an establishment of religion. Indeed, the Supreme Court foresaw the potential for secularism itself becoming established as a state religion. In one of the first cases abolishing school prayer, the Supreme Court acknowledged that the state may not establish a religion of secularism in the sense of affirmatively opposing or showing hostility to religion, thus preferring those who believe in no religion over those who do believe. I think we have to consider now whether we have reached that point. I think the time has come to recognize that the way we have chosen to organize publicly funded education in this country, by giving a monopoly to schools operated by the government, is not producing good educational results. And due to the diversity of religious belief in this country, is today constitutionally untenable. This arrangement can no longer finesse, as it did for over 100 years, the challenge of neutrality, as it did when religious attitudes of Americans were more monolithic. Nor is it capable of producing genuine religious neutrality. It has deformed and impoverished the very nature of the educational enterprise, either by purging it of any moral dimension or by trying to substitute for religion a secular value system that is at war with religion. It is reducing public schools to cockpits for a vicious winner-take-all culture war over the moral formation of our children. Obviously, one of the main reasons for the establishment of public education was to provide public funding for basic education up to a certain level of schooling. But public funding does not require, obviously, that it be done only in government-run schools. The alternative is obvious. It is to allow public funds to travel with each student, allowing the student and parents to choose the school, private, public, non-sectarian, sectarian, that best meets the need of the student. The state's interest in assuring that a certain level of basic skills are taught can be met by accreditation standards, but the government's ability to dictate the content of curriculum beyond this should be severely curtailed. And while there are likely to be conflicts over the accreditation standards, instances of government overreach would be far more transparent. This would not only be the most efficient way of providing publicly funded education, but I believe we have reached the point that it is the only way it can be provided today without imposing on religious liberties of the family. This doesn't mean the abolition of public schools. Parents who want to continue to send their kids to public school will have those schools. But parents will also have a choice. The time for implementing universal school choice has come. In a series of cases, the Supreme Court has clearly signaled that if the public is going to pay for children's basic education, it must pay for all children who attend academically qualified schools and must stop discriminating against children simply because their parents choose to educate them in a religiously affiliated school. I think that's the ultimate message of the main Blaine Amendment case, which DFI was directly involved in and I supported when I was Attorney General and then I supported after I left. It's a critical case that really lays the groundwork for a robust system of school choice. And happily, a voucher system will address perhaps the greatest injustice in America today. And that is our failure to give inner city children the opportunity to obtain the highest quality education. The failed educational system in our inner cities is a national disgrace, and we have tolerated it far too long. As I've said, if there's any systemic racism that exists in this country, it is the public school system in our inner cities. And as Condi Rice has said, it is the civil rights issue of our time. We must finally put the buying power in the hands of inner city parents, indeed in the hands of all parents, and allow them to choose for their children the best educational available to them in the school of their choice. With this buying power, those parents will no longer be at the mercy of bureaucrats. They will have the leverage and the wherewithal to finally make the system work for them. The Republican governors and state legislatures have the ball, and it's time to move that ball down the field. There will be fierce resistance. There are many entrenched interests. But any great and worthwhile reform necessarily involves disrupting the status quo. It is time for the Republican office holders to show leadership and courage. Thank you. Thank you very much. I stand ready to answer some easy softball questions. Anyone have a question?
Hi, General Barr.
Yeah.
Paul Schmidt, I litigate school choice issues for Alliance Defending Freedom. With respect to issues like Carson versus Macon, which you just referenced, and states that provide school choice options, one of the things we're seeing now is where states have now have to fund religious education after Carson, they're moving to try to find what you might describe as neutral and generally applicable rules that basically become a poison pill for religious schools so that they won't participate in these programs. What thoughts do you have on how courts can address that issue, which is basically kind of a backdoor discrimination? Thank you.
Yeah, I think it's going to be a long, hard slog because I think in some states we will not meet that much resistance. In other states, it'll be scorched earth resistance, efforts to use accreditation standards and other kinds of areas of claimed state interest to impose poison pills on the schools. And I think that's going to be have to be litigated, that the state does not have a sufficient compelling interest to impose those, you know, whatever the poison pill is, and that it is essentially a scheme of discrimination. You know, one of the ways of showing it is, I would think, that some school systems, like Catholic parochial schools, have been operating for over a century without these additional requirements. And so it then raises a question, why is it now necessary to impose these requirements on other schools? So it's hard for me in the abstract to answer this across the board. It just seems to me that we should expect efforts to, you know, to sabotage school choice, and we have to beat it back. Item by item, whatever they use, whether it be health or, you know, claim that certain things that are really not academic standards, but really injecting alternative values or control over religious teaching in the school simply are can't be sustained. Yeah.
General Barr, thanks for being here and for your comments. So you mentioned that one of the purposes, oh, this is Todd Sawicki from Scalia Law School over here.
Where are you?
Oh, over here.
Okay.
You mentioned that one of the purposes of the public school system was e pluribus unum. What I've understood, and tell me whether this may be incorrect, is that one of the reasons why we ended up with sort of a command and control type of public education system rather than the European model you talked about, which is more school choice, was really in large part to Christianize the Catholics. That a lot of that design was basically to crush the parochial schools and sort of bring, you know, the late 19th century bias against the Catholics and Catholic immigrants to, you know, Christianize and Americanize them. To what extent is that accurate? And to what extent is that part, we know the Blaine Acts and all these things were
right.
Very anti-Catholic. To what extent does that hover over this history?
Yeah, it's clearly accurate. Notice that the rationale, Horace Mann and his ilk made no bones about the fact that religion necessarily had, that education necessarily had to have a religious dimension. It's very subject matter means that it's going to be bumping into the religious realm. So you had to have religion. And they explicitly introduce religion, Protestant you know, sort of a pan-Protestant religion. So their objection to public, you know, they had no objection to using public funds to promote that religion, right? So it wasn't, you know, concern about establishment that had them do this. It wasn't concern over over religion. It was concern over the which religion. So they introduced pan-Protestantism. Obviously, the Catholics and the Jews, especially the Orthodox Jews, didn't like this. So the Orthodox Jews set up their yeshivas, and a lot of Catholics went to Catholic parochial schools. But I found a lot of old great speeches back in the middle of the 19th century where a lot of the Catholic leaders were basically saying, you know, this is crazy. You can't, you know, you basically have created this man-made, you know, religious scheme that's a little from here and a little from there, and you're putting in the school, and then you're going to make our kids go to that school. Where does the state get the power to ram this stuff down our throats? You can tell me what's legal and illegal, and you know what you will address in your courts of law, but you know you're not our moral teacher. And I think we have to recover that perspective. And I think we've lost it as a country. I can't understand why people are so docile in the face of the excesses of school boards. I mean, I know a lot of rebelling, but sometimes it's just on the fringe. Sometimes the debate's sort of on the fringe instead of just saying, you know, where do you get the, you know, where do you get the power to shove this down our throats? I just think that the state, I think we built our system on a you know, a fault line that was bound to disrupt the whole scheme. Because at the end of the day, the idea that the school can be that the government can be a moral agency is foolish, and we just sort of finessed it. But at the end of the day, it's not suited to that. It can't do it. And so, you know, for those who want to, you know, let the government handle all these problems, fine and dandy. But the best way of running it and the most efficient way and the way that will create the greatest diversity and enrich education and take the government out of the position of subverting the religious beliefs of Americans, a big portion of the American people, is by choice. So that's it. Thank you.